Well, good afternoon, everyone. Our project, or at least the goal of our SRR project, is the genetics and genomics and pathology of developing disease-resistant walnut rootstocks. And I guess given the title of this session, it's not absolutely necessary, but I still would like to recognize that this project simply wouldn't be possible without the support from the SRI project. And I'd also like to note that the matching support from the California Walnut Board has been incredibly generous to really facilitated completion of a lot of aspects of our work. And all the logos underneath are not there because they wrote us a check. Those are the folks that, those are the homes of the 14 co-PIs that are on our project. And as I go through, instead of giving a list with just everyone's name, I'm going to try to indicate the co-PIs that contributed to the various work as we go through the presentation here. So before I launch into the project, I thought I would just spend just a second talking about walnut rootstocks, because it's probably not the thing that's on most everyone's mind necessarily. So walnuts, commercial production of walnuts in California initially didn't use any rootstocks. It was in the beginning of the 1900s that rootstocks were beginning to be experimented, and through time it's evolved. The current situation, as shown here, is that about 75 to 80% of the walnut trees grown in California are on a rootstock called Paradox, and I'll talk about that in a second, either a clonal Paradox or seedling Paradox. About 10 to 15% of the industry is on Northern California Black, and about 5, 6% is on its own roots, grown on its own roots, English walnuts, English rootstock. And just to give you an idea, it looks like the top figure, the top photograph here is Paradox rootstock, and on the bottom is an orchard on California Black walnut rootstock. Now, like a lot of cultivars, Luther Burbank also had a hand in this. And in fact, Luther Burbank was the first person to develop the hybrid rootstock that we call Paradox, which is a cross between Northern California Black, Juglans Heinzii, and Juglans Regia, English walnut rootstock, English walnuts. And the reason that he generated that was simply because it was noted in Europe that hybrids similar to this had an amazing vigor. So that the photograph on the left is a Paradox tree that after about 16 years was 2 feet in diameter, whereas an English walnut tree of twice that age is about 8 or 9 inches. So it had amazing vigor, and hence the name was given by Luther Burbank as Paradox, having paradoxical vigor. And just the only sideline I'm going to have in this presentation here has to do with the photograph on the right. Those of you may be familiar with Luther Burbank in that picture. Does everyone know which one of those three is Luther Burbank? I don't see any hands in the audience. But Luther Burbank's in the one in the middle. And he was contemporary with Thomas Edison and Henry Ford. And they formed sort of a mutual admiration society. Each of them were writing to the other, expressing their admiration for the work they were involved in their particular industries. This is a photograph taken at Luther Burbank's residence and lab in Santa Rosa in California. However, this is one of the reasons this project was assembled. Paradox rootstock is, the Paradox genotype is incredibly sensitive to infection by Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which causes crown gall. And it's very common in orchards in California to find 10% of the trees infected. It's not terribly difficult to find orchards with over 80% of the trees looking like the photograph on the top right. If you zoom in on any one of those trees, you'll see the photograph on the bottom left, which is a photograph only a pathologist could love, and just kind of indicating how severe this can be in terms of disrupting the vascular architecture of that tree. It's no longer very thrifty, susceptible to all sorts of other secondary infections. So that kind of brings us to kind of answering the questions, why did we begin this project or put together this team to begin addressing this? So in addition to crown gall, there are several other soil-borne pathogens that account for about 18% yield loss each year in walnut production in California, which depending on the year can be $300 to $350 million loss. In addition to that, the other key feature is the rapid loss of chemical fumigants, and the restrictive use due to regulatory concerns. So the development of disease-resistant rootstocks is an alternative that we think is going to be useful in reducing the dependence on a lot of these chemical fumigants. And finally, the other major aspect of this project is to developing molecular markers to facilitate marker-assisted selection, which we then could use in juvenile selection to dramatically speed up the selection process for the breeders. So the presentation I have here is basically divided in three sections. The first section deals with the generation and then ultimately the screening or evaluation of the juglans germplasm and looking for individual genotypes that are resistant to the various key pathogens. And the key pathogens that were the focus of this study are shown here, with Agrobacterium being the top pathogen, Phytophthora, two different species of Phytophthora, Pratylenchus vulnus, lesion nematode, our malaria root rot, and a new emerging disease of rootstocks called thousand cankers disease. And for the sake of time, I'm only going to discuss two of them here to kind of illustrate the point or the direction the project's taking. We're going to talk about Agrobacterium and lesion nematode, and the work with Phytophthora and our malaria are tracking along similar lines. So we'll just launch into the first part. So this entire project really could never have been accomplished without having access to and our ability to exploit the National Clonal Germplasm Repository's collection in Davis, California, which maintains about 300 to 350 different juglans genotypes, which represents about 14 different species in the collection. And to exploit that, over the last 4 or 5 years, we've been going through and collecting open pollinated seeds from all members of this collection. We then go through the process, and over this last 3 or 4 years, we've germinated probably close to 15,000 open pollinated seeds to begin an idea of which members of that collection exhibit resistance to the key target pathogens that we're working on here. And I think I forgot to mention on the previous slide, but the same folks here, Chuck Leslie and Mali Araja, and Wes Hackett and John Priest are involved in this aspect of the project. So to make a long story as short as possible, the end result of this preliminary look at the entire germplasm collection really allowed us to narrow the focus down to one or two species that had a propensity to throw off disease-resistant open-pollinated half-sib progeny. And so we decided then as a group to focus on juglans microcarpa. And so using juglans microcarpa that we crossed with juglans regia pollen, we generated the breeding population. And here we're in the process. As a microbiologist, this was all news to me and how to go about doing this. But under the watchful eye of Chuck Leslie, who never let us escape doing something incorrectly, he would get us back on the straight and narrow, and we actually had a very successful pollination event and collected a high percentage of hybrids from this process. So, as I mentioned here, we pollinated and did the directed cross with two juglans microcarpa mother trees in the collection. And this is really the second major part of the project that really allowed everything else to flow, and that is to bring in, we were told by the genomics folks in our team that we needed at least 300 progeny from each of these crosses to begin doing some of the marker development work, and preferably more. So we collected 300 plus hybrid progeny from each of these two crosses for over 600 individuals that we brought back into the lab, surface sterilized those seeds, and then under aseptic conditions went and rescued the embryo from each of those 600 individuals, then germinated the embryo, induced shoot proliferation, and then the step after that would be to confirm that they were true hybrids, and we had a very high percentage of hybrids, so we had very few escapes in the pollination process. Then to take the natural steps then for in vitro propagation to get them to root, harden them off, get them growing in the greenhouse. We then, the ones that made it to this process, we then put through genotype by sequencing to identify the SNPs in the 600 individuals that are comprised our breeding population, and then ship them all off after all this tender loving care to the pathologist to attempt to kill them. So just to note, this process was pretty laborious, and this was one major surprise of the process, just how intense and how much work this turned out to be for a lot of reasons. But the bottom line is we generated 50 clonal plants for each of the 600 individual genotypes, all told about 35,000 plants that we in vitro propagated and passed through the are in the process of pushing through the disease resistance screen. And we also have to thank Duarte Nursery that stepped up and really helped us and also generated about 15,000 of those clones that have entered our disease resistant screening process. And so just a few words on the screening for agrobacterium and lesion nematode. So the agrobacterium screening process is the easiest of all the screenings that we have in our particular project. We simply dip an X-Acto knife into a 10 to the 9th suspension of agrobacterium and jab it exactly 2 millimeters depth into the crown of each of these small trees that are in pots, and then come back 2 to 4 months later, rate them, and we set them into 4 categories. The category on your left is trees that were exhibiting no tumor formation. That is, it was no different than a normal wound healing response. And position 2 was 25% or less of the circumference contained tumors, all the way up to a rating of 4, which was greater than 50% of the circumference contained tumors. And so this just gives you a snapshot of a small group of clones coming out of this. And what I'm trying to illustrate here is a couple things. Well, let me step back first and say that across the x-axis, these are individual clones from that 600-member breeding population. And then on the left side, which is difficult to see here, but there is either a rating of 1, 2, 3, or 4 corresponding to the disease-resistant rating. I put a red stripe at position at the rating of 2, above which we consider them to be highly susceptible and would not be interested in them for any breeding work. A rating of 2 or less, so below that line, is isolates that we'd consider resistant, or genotypes we'd consider resistant. So there are two things, take-home messages from this graph. One is, you can see on the right side, that a large number of these individuals, as you would expect, are incredibly sensitive to agrobacterium and cause tumor formation readily, or support tumor formation readily. And on the left side, we have a fair number of individuals that are highly resistant to agrobacterium. And so that indicating that disease resistance is segregating in this population. The other important thing is when you look at the left side here, these guys that are resistant from our experimental clones, they are resistant and behave much better than the two genotypes indicated by the red arrows. And these are the commercially available, commonly used genotypes in the industry now. So that was heartening that we're moving down the right path. Okay. And once again, this work is done a lot in my lab by Dr. McLean and Rachel Greenhut have been involved a lot in the generation of these data. So I'm going to switch gears now just to the lesion nematode work. And this is done by Andreas Westfall and Mike McHenry down at the Kearney Ag Center, UC Riverside. And as I mentioned, agrobacterium screening is very easy. Nematode screening is probably the most difficult of the pathogens that we are working with because all of the activity is done in the field. So we send down members of that 600-member breeding population to Andreas. They're planted out to in a field site that's known to contain high levels of lesion. In addition, he inoculates each of these trees at the time of planting. After 1 year, they're evaluated. If they meet certain criteria, they're then dug out with the tree spade, that's shown here, and then they're planted into more of an elite or secondary orchard that he maintains. And so these trees then are followed for 2, 3, and 4 years after inoculation. And so just to give you a snapshot of some of the results Andreas is finding, so this is the same kind of graph as I just showed you for agrobacterium, but now we're looking at the performance of the reaction of these individual clones, and that's across the x-axis here, and their performance in terms of resistance to lesion nematode. So just look at the top panel, and those are the data that he evaluated and came up with after year one. So that's what's shown here. So once again, you can see that the red bars are selections that maintain high levels of the nematode, and then we have a lot of individuals that had nematode populations at or below detection limits, which we were very happy about. However, if he waits the second year and does the exact same evaluation with the exact same genotypes, and that's what I'm showing here in year two, so these are the exact same individuals, now the story changes completely. And but the same two major points are still valid, and that is there does appear to be a segregation of the genetic loci that mediate nematode resistance in this population. And if we look at, I put stars by some of the experimental genotypes that are behaving better in terms of supporting nematode populations and growth responses than the commercially available rootstocks. And those are indicated by these black lines here. So the same good news was coming out of the lesion nematode screening work as well. And then Andreas has done subsequent work to show that it doesn't improve your predictive ability if you wait 3, 4, or 5 years. So now we've settled on 2-year evaluation for those nematodes. And just to give you an idea what that looks like, on the right side is the growth response after 1 year of the commercially available rootstock called RX1 in the presence of a site that contains high populations of lesion. And the same person, I might add, is in the picture on the left, showing the performance of one of the experimental clones under the same sort of nematode pressure, with nearly twice the amount of growth and half the number of lesion nematode population that's being supported in the root system. So from Andreas's work, currently we've moved about 33 new putative nematode resistant genotypes into more elite orchard that's being maintained now, and putting them back into to propagation to actually increase their numbers to look at future field trials with those. So those are the two examples. Just for the sake of time, I didn't want to get into a lot of detail with the others, but Greg Brown is working a lot with the Phytophthora, and we're along similar lines in terms of progress. And our malaria, Kendra's been helping us with that, and Dave Rizzo's lab as well. So the last two points I want to mention have to do with developing the genetic tools in this project. And just to say that, so the team, Ming Cheng Liu and John Dvorak on our team have done the bio-nanomaps, the optical maps. And so we've generated the 16 pseudomolecules representing each of the 16 chromosomes that occur in juglans. And using that then as a scaffold, we've been able to take the sequence contigs from the PacBio sequence that we've done for both mating partners in this cross. And now we've assembled a physical map in the case of the pollen donor SIR, which is shown on the right side here, where we have just 3 graphs, one in each of 3 chromosomes. So 13 of the 16 chromosomes is a complete scaffold. And so the same is true for juglans microcarpa. You can see we only have 3 gaps, and we're actively involved in closing those gaps at this time. So the physical map is really, really high quality for both mating partners. And then just to scare you with this map, this is our genetic linkage map that we've developed for both mating partners as well. I'm just showing you here microcarpa. And the purpose of this is simply to show you across the top are the 8 chromosomes onto which we've mapped the SNP markers from the GBS work that I mentioned in the early on in the first few slides. And so we have a nice distribution of SNP markers across all 16 chromosomes, which has allowed us to start some of the QTL analysis. And I'm happy to say within the last 2 weeks, we've done the analysis and have identified a major QTL for crown gall resistance on linkage group 11. And so now we're in a position, we think, to begin moving towards developing some of these marker-assisted selection process. And then the last slide, probably the most exciting part of all of this is some of the field trials we have. Each year, we as a team sit together and decide which are our best and most likely candidates. We just simply call that our elite germplasm. And then with the help of Sierra Gold, we clonally propagate those at a large scale. And now at the current time, we have 6 experimental genotypes that are in five very large field trials across the state, across the Central Valley of California, and they're in various stages of evaluation now, and some of which are looking quite interesting, and others, as you might guess, are a lot less interesting. But the bottom line is they're on field trials that we're really beginning to get a good look at this whole community of Juggins microcarpa by regia crosses for future rootstocks. And with that, I will, I think my time is up. The sign has gone up, so I'll just stop here. These are just a listing of some of the accomplishments that I've just discussed.
Okay, so we do have time for a few questions. Repeat the question, too.
The question was whether or not we're looking at dwarfing characteristics of these rootstocks. And so, in a sense, we put that into the initial decision to choose Juggins microcarpa because it has dwarfing tendencies for the cyan. And so, in general, the industry wants to move towards that. Most of the cyan's on Paradox. That really induces cyan vigor, and the trees get huge. And the growers are finding that to be just more and more of a problem. So that's a long-winded answer. The question is yes, we did, yes.
Other questions? Okay, thanks, Dan. Mm-hmm. Yeah.